We'll save questions till all three panelists have spoken.
Actually, Bob, I'm going to go to something that you ended with, or and end with it, which is actually a very, well, not a very, but a different concept of the role for have-nots that still requires funding, but maybe in a different way. Actually, before I begin, I wanted to just make a comment to Alan, and I think it probably is in several, which is, and this is really a compliment. This is either, okay, loose enough that it's actually going to be able to work or get no traction. I mean, what I like is, in a serious way, right, you're sort of putting it down in a way where if it actually had more information on what it was going to be on the RDA, that it would get completely derailed. And it may still not ever get there. But I really appreciate the fact that you've actually framed it in a loose enough way, because I think that's the way bottom-up efforts and chunking some of the themes that you're working on are really refreshing to hear, as opposed to centralized concepts of how it's all going to get done. So in that context, let's hope it's the first. As a stakeholder, I picture I'm up here with actually three hats on as a stakeholder, but actually I'm most interested in wearing a hat that I don't think you realize that I've begun to wear. So the three hats are spend a significant amount of time in academia, thinking of how it is that people are motivated to do what they're done do there. I also built up a biotech and saw what it's like to be living with people who are expecting a return in a rather short interval of time, but given an enormous amount of freedom to do what you want. And also sat on those big battleships called Large Pharma, being one of the senior executives at a pharmaceutical company running a discovery effort where you have you spend billions of dollars, literally, you spend billions of dollars, and you have thousands of people who are able to do it. And I have three take-home points that I want to make sure I get across, and then I'll go to the first slide. The first is about rewards in all of those systems, and the importance that I think needs to be attention played to what's going to motivate people. Secondly, the need for a compute space. So we've talked a lot about freeing up data, and I'm going to talk about the fact that actually freeing up data is not good enough. Actually, interoperability is not good enough. Things won't happen if you had all the data you wanted to free up and you made it all interoperable. That's not going to get you there. Because I want to talk about the pace of discovery when publication is the mechanism by which you decide whether someone has credit versus rapid learning that's used in other disciplines. And I want to talk about the role of citizens, which is going to get back Bob to this have-not aspect. I want to also set the stage a little bit for you, for those who don't know the area that I work in, about what has been, I think, a pretty awesome shift in the amount of data that's available and the value of it when it comes to understanding diseases. So up until recently, it's been the astronomers, it's been the physicists, it's been the meteorologists who can talk about, we have ectabytes, we have this, we have that. Be prepared for a world of health information that's going to eclipse that. And the reason it's needed is that currently virtually every drug that anyone takes in this room or any of your family members takes, the chance that it actually is going to work in you is less than 50%. It's usually about 1 in 4. And we give drugs out to everyone assuming everyone would get it, because we assume they all are sort of like, we're all humans, right? And more importantly, all the drug discovery efforts that are done with a concept that a target can be chosen by looking at some biochemical chart that's going to apply to what is a good protein to make a drug against, and it's going to be the same in every person. What we're waking up to is actually the need for new maps and new models of diseases that are going to need to be as accurate and as impactful as the weather maps predicting tornadoes that, Kelvin, you showed earlier. We're going to live in a world where the contour maps say, if I eat two cheeseburgers, I've just moved this far towards atherosclerosis. We're going to live in this world. The amount of data and what that means and how that's going to change our world is going to be as impactful as GPS was to figuring out how you're going to navigate. That world, as it moves through, is not going to... So the tools that would allow you to generate that information are coming through in ways that I don't need to describe. They're just beautifully coming into place. The problem is that the current incentives and the ways that people work together and information is siloed was completely built for the medical world in a way where everything lined up in reward structures, whether it's for institutions or hospitals or doctors, patients in ways that actually don't assume that that's actually something you would want to do. Let's see. So after having spent that period of time in academia, biotech, and industry, 3 years ago, I split off and started what I think in what we were talking about today is one of these bottoms-up efforts 3 years in as running a nonprofit foundation whose whole interest it is in seeing what does it take to live in an information commons. So we have about 30 people. We're in Seattle. We get very well funded. We have about 21 projects going on. And this is the important thing. We see ourselves as an incubator for matchstick projects of building a biomedical information commons. We have no interest in taking those on. And in fact, I don't think we're in a good position to take those on. But there needs to be a structure where groups such as ours that can try a little this, try a little that out, don't have to take those and scale them all the way up. There need to be groups that can fail half the time, just the way DARPA uses those efforts in the biomedical world, which are not where the NIH funding structures currently exist. It's not run that way. There needs to be a DARPA-type structure for building these tests of what it takes to get people to work together. And we have been working on how do you make get data usable. What I'm referring to here is if you look at rules on making things public, there are these clauses that say you'll make this, put this in the public domain. That's usually an Excel table that you've got to work very hard to get and then can't do anything with it. So I'm talking not accessible, I'm talking about usable. I'm talking about reward recognition, which I'll go to, governance, how to distribute tasks and privacy barriers. But what we've been working on is how could you have a way where clinicians, data generations, patients, citizens could actually get in and look at all the raw data, the curated data, have the tools and methods, have ways to do analyses and build models. Because this is the next important thing I want you to leave with. There is going to be no such thing as a perfect model of a disease. And I guess that's sort of what you'd say about in terms of weather maps. You know, every time a patient puts a piece of information in, the model gets better. And we're going to look back at the maps that we have today, like I showed on that first slide, and laugh at them. We're going to laugh at the ones that are there 20 years from now. We're on a 20 to 100-year arc of actually really being able to live in this world. And we have to build the structures that will allow that, what we call knowledge expert, to be able to sit in that way. The National Academy of Sciences and Institute of Medicine put out a brilliant report in December. I don't think I've ever said that about an NAS report. A brilliant report called Precision Medicine. And in that, they laid out some very interesting things that need to be done in order to be able to build an information commons. And it's really about the phrasing I like is building a knowledge expert, where it's about connecting so that anything that's happening to any one person and their health is actually being captured and it's being able to be fed together and to understand whether it's diabetes or Alzheimer's or something else. So I want to describe two of these equivalent of the matchstick projects that we've been working on. GitHub, for those of you who are not in software engineering, is a site you should go on and look at if you want while I'm giving this talk. GitHub is a site that's only 4 or 5 years old. It started out with a pretty low usage, but now has, this is about a couple of months old, so now it's 4 million repositories and over 2 million people using it. The thing has just lit up. And what they realized was whether you're a team from Microsoft or whether you're an open source group that's trying to get anyone involved, it's very valuable to have a way so that you can put your work out there and draw the equivalent of Google circles around who you want to be seeing it, working on it, and change that all the time. And so every code change is versioned, every issue is tracked, every project that's a starting point for new work is there, and it's about provenance, okay? It's about a way of giving credit to who's doing what and allowing people to see who's doing what and doing it in real time. And so we started on a project 2 years ago called Synapse. And Synapse is basically very directly borrowing from GitHub in terms of concept and building out a compute space for people in the biomedical world, where you could take the various data sets that you want to work on and download them, work on them, and put them up for anyone to see that you decide should be working on it. We have used the same concepts of data and code and analysis that is there, and what we have and put leaderboards on and forums. And for example, I think someone from the NIH, right? Is Jerry, you're here. We took the TCGA data. Okay, that's very hard to get to. We took all the TCGA data. This is with working with David Hausler at UCSC, and we've put it in a way where you can go into any tumor type that you want. You can take the raw data. You can get to the curated data. You can go and set up a query that's being done in one tumor type and then go across all the other tumor types, and automatically the thing that you'd set up for one tumor type you can do on others. So this is important. Data repositories, particularly in medicine, are pretty mature. The National Library of Medicine, NCBI, have done a pretty remarkable job. The data standards around expression are reasonable. The work that's done in terms of getting data out from the genome project is pretty mature. But it's remarkable that there's no place where you would expect anyone to work with another on that work. So this is not about building a repository. This is about building a compute space where you could allow someone to share something with someone else. We took six leading labs who all competed with each other for papers in Nature or Science, and we tried an experiment that's called the Federation off of Star Trek. And we said, let's let all of these six labs take all their data, all their models, and all their tools and share it together and see what would happen if they could compete better against others and get their papers sooner if they were willing to act as one federation. And we've set up some projects. We've got some things out of it, but I'm bringing it up because it was in some ways a failure, and I'm bringing this up because it wasn't good enough now to have data released, interoperability, and a compute space, because people still worried that they weren't going to be able to get the credit that they wanted. Publication was still too strong of a motivation for them to do it, and in some ways, it's a setup to what we found really to be, in contrast, just working remarkably. So borrowing from the concepts of the groups who worked in structural biology and Foldit, the groups like Adrian Truel working on Eterna, the groups that have worked on Innocentive, XPRIZE, we sat there and figured out, was there a way to actually make it that people could share by competing? So what we did was we took a data set that had just come out of Nature a couple of months ago that was on breast cancer, and it was in women who had had breast cancer where their records were for 15 years, and we had expression profiling on their tumors. We had copy number variation. It was a new data set where we also had a data set we could leave out as a validation set. and we put out, started a challenge or a co-op petition working with IBM and a couple of others, and said, what happens if we have a contest where you, when you enter the contest, you have to put your code. So this is different from other contests. You have to put the code that you said is what allowed you to build the classifier. And we got Google to give us free space so that all the data, all the versions, and the code were there for anyone to use, and made the prize at the end of it an automatic publication with no peer review in Science Translational Medicine. So we got the editors to agree that actually people will work, scientists will work for papers where they're the first author on that paper, okay? And if you say you don't have to go through peer review and you can get it automatically because it is better than what's out there, the argument we made was that actually better than peer review is actually you beat everyone else. A competition should intrinsically be better than peer review. And this worked, and so I bring this up because July 17th we opened this up. 140 groups from 20 countries got on. We gave no advertisements. We did no advertising for this. It's now at 300 to 400 groups. There are groups 40 around the world who are on the leaderboard. There's a Chinese who we never heard of who beat all those six labs that we put in the federation and did the first iteration. So Stanford, Columbia, bonk, 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 down the line, got beaten by an individual who had come out of nowhere with a beautiful way of doing that. And I think that if we're going to have a way where we're going to have a research data alliance, don't underestimate the power of not having to pay people to look at the data if you can come up with a reward structure that is one which is attuned to the nature of the of this next generation. And the other reason I bring up this example is that we've been working with a number of disease communities. We've been working with Fanconi anemia, which is a form of bone marrow failure, and beginning to ask whether instead of going into the, what I call the military-industrial complex, academics, industry, and government, instead asking questions of citizens as patients of what they're interested in and finding that not only will they provide their sample and their data, but the thing that's more importantly is some of the best insights and questions that can be posed come when you start taking citizens and you start asking them, what is it that you would want to see done with your disease? And that the concept of an expert, I can say this because I'm an MD, PhD, is not with the number of letters you have behind your name. It's how much passion do you have about a subject. I am convinced that whether you go into understanding the Higgs boson or whether you're talking about understanding Alzheimer's, we underestimate significantly the role that citizens could play. But if it's done as some unscience, citizen science to the side, it's not going to be anywhere as powerful as if there's a way where that energy and that passion can intersect with real experts that are sitting there ready to help. And so the fourth hat that I think I wanted to put on here is, if we're thinking of building an alliance, please make sure that we have it done in a way where, from the standpoint of insights that citizens themselves and the records that they can be put in, can put in are there, whether it's the barometric pressure in their neighborhood house or what it is that happened to them with a vet who's trying to cope with post-traumatic stress syndrome, we have to have a way where we're collecting data directly from the people who are there, quote, in the field. Also, don't underestimate, and this is, Bob, to your point, the willingness of citizens to directly pay for things. So we're running a new project, a longitudinal cohort study in Parkinson's, where we're going to take and have real names of the patients with Parkinson's and whole genome sequence and their real name. They're going to put their real name and their whole genome sequence. They want it out there, okay? They want it shared. They want everyone to see it. And they want to give what's happening to them every day. And this is called Real Names Discovery Project. And then we said, but we have no money to fund this. Would you pay $50,000 to be in the study? And they said, sure. Not only that, but people are stepping up and saying, I will pay for other people. I don't have that disease, but I like your study, and I'll pay for someone to join. So they're giving sponsorships for people to join. So I think that if you, Alan, are putting together something, I don't think you have any concept of how much data is sitting out there and could come in, and could come in without having to have government money to start it, if there's a way to connect so that there are rewards for scientists who do not currently get rewarded for not sharing. Okay, they get rewarded for not sharing until they get their publication, and are able to bring in citizens so that they're a part of it. And that's the reference to the have-nots. Is I think sometimes there's a way to include it, which I think actually is a little different, Bob, than you mentioned. But I've just been really surprised at the ability of people to do that. So what we're puzzling, if you want to know what we're doing at Sage Bio Networks, is we're asking in one subdomain, which is about building better models of disease. But you could put better models of energy use. You could put it of weather. But for this particular area, we've been working on what kind of technology platforms do we need, what type of governance, how do we do challenges, and what kind of scientific models can we put out there? And the question we've been asking is, who wants to live in that type of information commons? Who's the first constituent in? Who should we be helping to get in? We had always thought that it would be pharma or biotech or academic consortium. That's for the first 2-3 years of who we were trying to get to join into that information commons. And now what we're realizing actually is that Google and Amazon and the IT companies actually have real funds and real interest, and they have a role to play that we had forgotten about, that individual patients are able to participate, patient foundations. But the one that's in the bottom that I think is the most important is somehow making it so that there are joint patient-scientist communities that aren't just citizens doing it, are not just this is being done through UCSF, but instead where the control and the ownership and who is expected to be accountable for deliverables is broadened a little bit beyond the ways we usually think of the experts.